Matt Haig, best-selling and award-winning author of novels and children's novels, but his latest book is very different to the works of fiction that he's won praise for, called Reasons to Stay Alive. It's a true story that charts his long battle with depression. I began by asking him about the opening to his book when he talks about the moment he suffered from a nervous breakdown 13 years ago.
I mean, the thing is with the term breakdown, doctors tend to sort of frown on that term, but that, for people who've gone through that, the experience that I've went through, I don't think there's a better word, really. You feel perfectly fine one day, and the next day, everything is broken. Everything is wrong in your head. You look exactly the same. You can look as healthy as anything or whatever, but you are suddenly very ill. And I was very ill. I basically fell into... I didn't realise it at the time, but, anxiety disorder and depression at the same time, which is a very common thing. You know, they often go together.
Can you describe when you have a nervous breakdown? Can you describe the feeling in your head?
It was a feeling of intense dread. I was also getting physical symptoms. Like, I would actually feel... one of the big myths of mental illness is that it is just about thoughts, but I was also getting physical symptoms in my head. My limbs felt suddenly heavy, and I was having a panic attack, so my heart was palpitating.
But explain to me I remember I was talking to Alistair Campbell about this, yeah. Matt, who, of course, took a breakdown as well.
Yeah.
And he described in his head, the way he described it, he said, if you imagine a pane of glass and the glass is completely shattered, yeah, and you've got little splinters, and that's what he described heartfelt to him. How did it feel to you in your brain? I'm trying to understand what a nervous breakdown is.
Right. Well, I think the thing is it totally, everything that makes you you, your whole worldview on everything, is fundamentally changed. Depression doesn't alter your perspective. It becomes your perspective. So you're suddenly in this new reality. I wasn't delusional. I knew exactly who I was. But I it was like everything was suddenly seen through this very sort of claustrophobic, dark reality. And it was terrifying because it was bewildering. It was like suddenly being parachuted into some dark forest that you've never been to. And, you could see everything around you looked exactly the same, yet you suddenly felt like an alien in your own skin. I felt, I think the medical term is derealized. I felt suddenly like I wasn't real, like I was transported from another reality into this one. So the most familiar face, I had a long-term girlfriend who's now my wife. She was there. She was looking after me and stuff. But she might have been a million miles away. You know, everything felt so detached.
Derealization is a really interesting medical concept, actually, isn't it? And people describe it as a nearly like a dreamlike sequence that you're nearly looking down, watching your own life and watching people around you as if you're looking down on them, and yet you're in it.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like a literal out-of-body experience, but you feel almost sort of beamed in. And I just found it so intense. That's what people think of depression, and I suppose the stereotype for someone who hasn't had depression is of someone sort of lying under the duvet on a sofa and just sort of being a bit sleepy and tired and just can't be bothered to do anything. But what that doesn't translate, and the thing that's invisible, is the sheer intensity of it. And I think the reason why... tragically, so many people end up committing suicide with this illness, and I think suicide rates absolutely could and should be brought down. But I think what people need to understand is that feeling of being trapped and of there being no way out. There are ways out, but that is the feeling it gives you.
What led to this? What created it?
I don't know. In my case, I don't know.
Where were you?
I was in Ibiza, so I wasn't living exactly a healthy lifestyle. But I've got a family history of depression. I was a young man who had no sort of idea of who I was. So I start to see it now as a kind of premature midlife crisis or quarter life crisis, whatever you want to call it. And everything was coming to a head. We'd been working in for three summers in a row in Ibiza. It was time to sort of face the real world again. We'd just bought our plane ticket back to London.
But you're in this beautiful place, Ibiza.
Yes.
Of course, beautiful island. It's crazy. It's surrounded with craziness. Part of the attraction to some people about it is it's surrounded with craziness and mayhem and excess. And you're on this beautiful island, you're enjoying yourself, and then the next day, you're falling apart.
Yes, it was a process of a week. I'm not a squeaky clean person. I have taken drink and drugs in my life. But I can tell you, the week I was ill, we were sort of winding down. We had, you know, Ibiza is crazy, but we were living in a villa on a remote part of the island. We'd sort of done all that stuff. I wasn't sort of living like a monk, but, I wasn't in that place then when I did this. If I'd have never touched a drop of anything in my life, would this have ever happened? I honestly don't know. My mum has suffered with depression. I don't know if I'd have been a bit physically healthier at the time, would I have not got this? I don't know. But I think that combination, that trigger of anxiety, of things building up inside you, and you're not sort of acknowledging them, and then it sort of floods in, is quite a common experience as a sort of route into depression.
How low did you get?
I got incredibly low. I desperately wanted the courage to kill myself. I didn't have that courage, but we were living beside a cliff in the sort of beautiful southeast.
Or stupidity to take your life.
Sorry?
Or stupidity to take your life.
Yeah, totally. You know? But
because the very clear message, and you'll understand that, why I'm interrupting you.
Exactly.
The very clear message to anybody today who's contemplating taking their own life, please get help, please don't do it, and we will give numbers at the end of this programme so you can get help, and Matt's story is a case in point of how you can get through
absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. And the trouble is, I wish, what I was trying to do with this book is I was almost trying to make a telephone call through time, because you foolishly, and it's not foolishly because it's depression and it gives you these symptoms, but they are symptoms. It's not reality. Depression tells you a lot of stuff, and a lot of stuff that is disproved by time. Like in my case, it said you won't amount to anything. You won't live to see 30. Then you live to see 30. And depression slowly loses its power. You have to sort of hold on tight through the roller coaster ride. But if I could tell anyone with depression, if there's one message I would give them, it is that all those things depression is telling you, it's not true. It's symptoms of an illness. And, you have a future, and the future is not going to be the same as this present you're trapped in. And, of course, everything's not going to get worse, because not much does get worse than when you're feeling suicidal and that low. So you're at the low point now. That's what I would say.
How scary was it?
Oh, it's terrifying. It's totally terrifying. It's... there's no off switch, but that's the thing. It took me months to sort of feel halfway normal. I didn't care, and I think this is a common feeling with depressives. I didn't really care about happiness, about being, happy. That seems so far removed. It's like if you're in physical pain, all you care about is not feeling that pain. It's exactly the same with mental pain. I just wanted to feel neutral. I wanted to sort of feel empty and normal, and to just have a moment of not thinking about it. It was exhausting. It exhausts you just having it there in the foreground. And of course, it's a sort of vicious circle, because then you're thinking about it more, and then it becomes more dominant. And you kind of have to disrespect. Well, I discovered over time is you kind of have to disrespect your own depression, because depression is this sort of solemn dictator, and you need to just sort of use humour and just belittle it and try and pretend it's background, even though it is massively foreground. And eventually it will slowly stop dominating you if you don't always sort of aggrandise it like that.
You said that you feared going mad.
Yeah.
In your book.
Yes, absolutely. I I was petrified. I was petrified, A, of dying. It sounds silly, but, you know, being suicidal doesn't necessarily take away the fear of death. And I was petrified also of going mad. I kept on seeing myself in a sort of straitjacket. You know, all the cliches of mental illness from having watched, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or whatever. I thought I was going to just be, you know, lose it completely, and I never did. You know, I was just in a lot of pain, and I was irrational about certain things. I became phobic about medication. I was put on some medication early on, and it didn't quite work for me, and then I became very sort of resistant to that, and certain things were a bit irrational. But I always knew who I was. I knew everyone around me. I knew I was ill. I never, you know, thought I was anyone else. So it wasn't madness, yet I was petrified that I would get worse. You know, even though you're in this bad state, you're constantly thinking, oh, I'm going to get worse.
So that's why suicide was attractive?
Yes.
You'd rather die than go mad.
Yeah. I mean, attractive is not really the word. It's just like, you know, if a house is on fire, you want to jump out the window, but you don't necessarily want to jump out the window. It's just the other alternative. But, it's a totally... depression makes you think these things, but, again, you've got to sort of try and find your real self removed from depression. You are not the illness, even though depression tries to sort of take you over.
More women have depression than men,
yeah,
and yet more men take their own lives than women. Now, I wonder why that is.
It's a very strange thing. Apparently, the figures used to be a bit more even. It used to be, you know, if you go back to like the early 80s, in the UK certainly, the figures were roughly matched. But now, men are 3.5 times or something too likely to take their lives than women, even though more women officially are depressed. Now, there's different ways of looking at this, but I would take from that there's been massive progress made in terms of women, in the sense that as many people are getting depressed, but with women they're not dying from this illness, whereas men still are. And I think women are more prepared sometimes to talk and to open up and to go and get help and to call it what it is than men. And often it masks itself in different ways. It's not necessarily just stigma. Sometimes, you know, in men it can come out as anger, it can come out as these various things, and we can sort of think the answer's, you know, at the bottom of a bottle or whatever, and, you know, different coping mechanisms come into play.
You see, I was reading your story. I'm aware of how important your partner, Andrea, was in keeping you alive and helping you through this.
Yeah, this is true.
And it just struck me, my goodness, I wonder could you have got through this on your own, as many people with depression are.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. I did have, I suppose, some kind of safety net. I had parents alive. I had a sister, and I had Andrea, a girlfriend. At the same time, although that very much helped me with my recovery, when I was at my very lowest point, I couldn't really connect to them. I couldn't really... It sounds a terrible and selfish thing to say, but I couldn't... Because I was in such pain, I couldn't really think about them or their feelings or anything like that, because I was just sort of drowning in it for a little while. I'm so glad they were there for when I got a bit better to help with the recovery. But, yes, it is very, very useful and helpful to have someone you can be open to about it. And I do understand that for some people there aren't that many people that they can feel comfortable talking to. Though I also, at my sort of worst states, I did, when I came back to England, I phoned helplines and things like that and talked to people and counsellors and stuff as well. And that also, sometimes talking to a stranger is actually gives you more confidence to talk about it as well.
Yeah, it's talking therapy and people that go and get counselling. Sometimes people don't realise how beneficial talking therapies can be. And I remember interviewing, I think it was Alistair Campbell actually, who was telling me just to offload that, to unload, it is incredibly therapeutic.
Yes, because you have this intensity inside you, and it's like a pressure cooker. If you just suddenly let it out, so if you externalise it, if you take something that's in your head that feels so unreal and you actually describe it in words or tell someone about it, somehow it becomes manageable or more manageable just by doing that, because it feels so alien. So you give it these human terms, and then suddenly it is completely out there. I mean, you're still suffering, obviously, but it feels like something shared rather than that's just, you know, drowning you.
I'm thinking of the people that don't understand, who will tell someone with depression, cheer up, pull yourself out of it.
Mm.
What have you got to be worried about? You've got money. You've got success. You've got a family. For goodness sake, pull yourself together.
Yeah. I mean, we have come a long way, but this attitude does still prevail. And I think one of the problems is it's an invisible illness. But what people have to understand is it's not an emotion. It's not, you know, you're not depressed because your football team have lost. You're not depressed because it's Monday morning and you've got to go to work or the weather's bad. Depression is an illness. It's like, you know, to ask the question, what have you got to be depressed about? You would never in a million years say, what have you got to have cancer about? Or what have you got to have arthritis about? It's an illness. And I think people who've properly experienced depression, and absolutely, there's no question in their mind that it's an illness. You've broken down in the same way you break down with physical illness. But I do totally understand that, A, it is very hard often to be there for someone with depression in all sorts of ways. And it's this invisible thing, yeah.
How do you keep it at bay now, then?
Well, there's no magic formula. I mean, I'm still prone. Last year, I had 3 weeks last January feeling very bad. The difference now is I do sort of know my triggers. So I know if I've had a long patch of very late nights, or I've been drinking too much, or I'm just too stressed about work, you know, I'm missing deadlines and I'm getting too old. I don't always do it. I'm not perfect, but I try consciously to take a step back. When I actually have dips again, it's never as bad as it once was, because when I first had it, and this is the terrifying thing for people who first fall into depression, that first bout of depression, you think, this is going to be it. This is my new reality forever. How can I cope with this? How can I cope with this? So at least time gives you the knowledge that however dark the tunnel is, there is that light there, and you are going to head towards it if you just sort of hold tight, keep your head down, be sensible. And over time as well, I genuinely believe that depression has many, many factors. You don't always work out what caused your depression, and so it also has many, many cures. And what works for me doesn't necessarily work for someone else.
I hope this isn't a stupid point I'm about to make, but I wonder if being an author is dangerous if you have depression. It just strikes me as such a solitary job, that you're not surrounded with people, and therefore you can sink in your own depressive state.
Yes, I think writing always, you know, when we do these silly top 10 lists of most depressing jobs, being a writer or any job, being any sort of freelance job where you're working from home on your own, it is quite isolating. I spend I'm lucky that I have a family that I live with, and so I do see people and I do talk to people, and we live in the centre of a town, and I sort of go out and about as much as possible. But yeah, it can be, except I find writing itself as a form of communication. It might be a different type to sort of going to the shop, but it's all sort of communication. So I like that side of it. And I'm very, nowadays with the internet and social networks and Facebook and Twitter and all of that, you can sort of have your water cooler moments without it being in real life, as it were.
Why have you written this book, Matt?
Well, I was asked to. I always wanted to. I've sort of always hidden behind fiction. So I've written about it in different ways before, but always, you know, it's never been me. And I think it's taken me a lot of time to get the confidence to do it. I wanted to write this book because when I was ill, I wanted to hear about experiences, but I was petrified that reading about things like it would actually make me more depressed. So I wanted to try and find a way. I don't necessarily know if I've done it, but what I was trying to do with this book was to write the book me at 24 would have wanted to read or would have got some sort of solace out of it. It. Not necessarily all the answers, but just that feeling of being understood, which hopefully is therapeutic as well.
I wonder, are we all prone to depression?
I think, you know, some people are more susceptible than others, but I think I genuinely believe anyone could potentially get depression, whether there'd be a specific external trigger for it or it would just, in some people, it would just come on whatever, I think. But, yeah, I mean, the figures now are something like 1 in 5 people. And these figures are rising as sort of stigma lessens, because I think people are more willing to sort of be diagnosed and come out about it. But I genuinely believe, as with so many of the things, it's a human illness. It's a universally human illness. It's a terrible thing to have happen, but it's a very common thing and one that anyone can have. And I also believe, even if you don't have depression and anxiety, and I hope people don't, because it's not a very pleasant thing to have, but I believe we've got to start looking at mental health a bit how we look at physical health. No one would ever go around and say, oh, I'm 100% physically healthy, and I think we should start looking at mental illness the same way. We're all on a scale. We're all, you know, and the physical body is very related to the mind too. We obviously have separate hospitals for the mind and the body for good reasons, but that creates in our head this idea that somehow mental illness is other, and it doesn't help the stigma side of it, I think. And we've just got to sort of grow up about that a little bit and understand that anyone can get it. It is an illness. It's not a personality trait.
Your book is called Reasons to Stay Alive. Final question. What Yes. are your reasons to stay alive?
My reasons to stay alive is for the future that doesn't exist yet, but I know will happen. My reason to stay alive is that life contains so many wonderful things that I would have missed out on if I'd have let depression decide my fate. And my reason to stay alive is just all that possibility that does exist in your life that will happen if you just stay awake.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.